Welcome to episode 76 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes, and about a month ago, it was the Cycle Touring Festival. So, for a short weekend, headed over to Clitheroe in Lancashire, and again, it was another interesting weekend of people talking about where they'd been on their bike, talking about their experiences, giving advice, etc. And one of the people who was giving a talk this year was Tim Sanders. Tim has been to every single touring festival since it started in 2015. And he was giving a talk about cycling on the Istrian Peninsula and then into Italy and up to Munich in southern Germany. And on the Sunday afternoon, I had a chat with him about his experiences.
Okay, so I'm Tim Sanders, I'm 56, I work as an engineer in the southwest of the country.
Yeah, any more than that? Is that it? Right, okay, but you haven't mentioned one thing. The one thing you haven't mentioned is that you're the, apart from Tim and Laura, who actually organise it, you are the, I think, one of only two people to have attended every single cycle touring festival in-person event, and probably online as well, since it was...
I think that might be correct.
Since it was first one in 2015?
Yeah, I was planning a trip in late 2014, early 2015, and I was looking online, and then I suddenly saw this website. Actually, no, it was the Cycle Touring Club forum, and saw a reference to this festival. I thought, oh, that's fantastic. Right, instantly I booked. And then I told a friend of mine about it, who lives up the road in Somerton. And very quickly he booked too, very spontaneously. So he came to the first one. There were various people I'd heard of online, like Helen Lloyd, Tim and Laura. So it was a good chance to pick up tips, get some ideas. And several trips that I have done have been inspired by things I've learnt here, like the Eurovelo, the Chile trip I did in 2019. That was following a talk that I saw in 2019 earlier. So it's very inspirational.
Yeah, and it's also chucking it down, but we'll persist with the rain. I was just thinking that I can't remember how I first heard about it, because I couldn't come to the first one because I was travelling from Spain to Norway on my bike. It was that summer or that spring, if May of 2015, and I don't know whether I'd heard about it at the time or not. I must have stumbled upon it somehow.
I suspect it's the sort of thing that once it happened, word got out. And I think Laura said last night that there were 150 on the first session, whereas subsequent years, pre-pandemic, it was several hundred. I guess we're talking 250-ish. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've got to 300. So word clearly got out. And there are many people who've come year after year, fewer in the last couple of years, but the last two years sessions have been gatherings rather than festivals. It was a more limited affair. But then the last 3 years we've had an online festival, which is great insofar as that people from outside of the UK can come. It's a long way to come from Somerton to get to Clitheroe, but a worthwhile trip.
I was surprised when she asked yesterday morning for people to put their hands up that who hadn't been before, who were here for the first time. It was still a good number of people doing it for the first time.
And I think that's great, because there are many that have come for the first time I've been talking to who've done plenty of cycle touring before, others who haven't done it, but really think it might be quite fun to do, and it's a festival for all people at all levels, and I'm sure there will be people here that have done some pretty spectacular stuff. They still think, oh, that's a good idea.
Well, yeah, I mean the great and the good of the cycle touring world have been, you know, apart from Tim Moore's never been, has he?
I mean like Tom Allen, who's overseas now. There's Helen Lloyd, who's done some quite spectacular things.
Stephen Fairns.
Yes, yes. I mean, I was also thinking of, say, last night we had a procession of bikes where people that volunteered could bring their bikes into the, like a catwalk. It was called a catwalk, wasn't it? Mm. And you saw some great examples of different bikes. And no one bike was the same. With touring bikes, people are very particular to make it work for them, either size-wise or fitting on racks. Now with e-bikes, it's meaning that when you get to a certain age, you can continue doing it.
Yeah, it is a very inclusive thing. There's no hierarchy, I don't feel, when I come to these things.
And the fun on Friday was, well, I hadn't had a chance to eat. I came with a sandwich made it from Subway. I just sat down in the marquee that we've got and was quickly joined by other people I've never met. I had absolutely great time. And it was good. You know, they had stuff to bring, and they were also keen to hear what would be said over the weekend.
Yeah, I delayed my departure because I've got a terrible cold, hence the cough. But yeah, I arrived yesterday morning, and hopefully I'm recovering. But did you think when you came to that first one, back in 2015, that, how many years later is this? 8 years later? Yeah, 8 years later, you'd actually be delivering one of the talks?
I think I had no expectations about what it might be. I mean, as I said, I'd heard of various people who were attending. I did do one of the online talks in August 2021 about the Chile trip. I wasn't sure I'd ever be speaking, but well, you know, there are so many different stories that can be told, and I suspect there's many more great stories that we didn't hear from. Maybe next year we'll hear from them.
Well, the big question mark about the festival is the fact that it is held at a girl guide centre called Waddo Hall, which is where we are now, and the Girl Guides Association are actually closing, they're selling this establishment. So there's a question mark as to whether it will still be here next year or whether Tim and Laura move it elsewhere. So I hope they do, because my life would be a little bit emptier if it didn't take place.
Well, you see, having been to this festival so many times, and there are, I was surprised how few had been to every session, but I think that, and the inclusivity that you mentioned is a good point, but there are so many people that come year after year, and many that come that are new. And what I've noticed is that people don't only talk to the people that they know well, and it can be very easy to see so-and-so that you've not seen in for a year. I think people here do look out for people that are unknown. I mean, part of the problem is you might not know the people unknown because there's all of your life's been happening in the last year, and you might have just forgotten the odd face, but we put name badges on, we get talking to each other.
I think it's still an excellent festival, and all credit to Tim and Laura for, you know, because it must be a hell of a lot of work, especially because they've got a young family now.
They've created.
But I do kind of miss that pre-pandemic festivals in that it took place in May. The weather was a bit nicer.
Yeah.
There was a bit more buzz about it, but like you say, it's more of a, it is now referred to as a gathering rather than a festival.
It's a very different one. In the pre-pandemic, the festivals were, as you say, held at Waddo Hall, and we were using the Waddo Hall building, which had a big main room that we could all get in, and several side classrooms and several other buildings, such as Ribble Lodge, where we could hold smaller gatherings. I think it must have been a nightmare for Laura and Tim to decide, okay, that talk's going in that room, because you have to guess, okay, that room takes 50 people. The main hall takes several hundred people. So you could have several sessions happening concurrently, whereas now it's largely event talks happening consecutively. And inevitably, in the pre-pandemic ones, you could find yourself, oh no, there's two different things I want to be on at the same time, so you just have to choose. But going back to when it's sighted, the weather is much better at May, but May is also edging into the cycle touring season. in Northern Hemisphere. I mean, I would say that winter is the traditional cycle tour planning season. And, yeah, it's a difficult one. Some cycle tourists are harder than others. And, yes, it's been quite wet this weekend, and it's not looking that optimistic for taking the tents down later. So I'm expecting to have a wet tent to dry off over the week.
Yeah, I mean, I am. I'm being very picky there in terms of my comments, because I think it still is an excellent event. And it does make sense, I suppose, to have it at this time of the year, because people have been on their, a lot of people have been on their trips. They've got more to reflect on, and then they're beginning to perhaps have a few ideas for the following year. So it is a good forum to come to, to hear what possibilities, and then to spend several months thinking about them and procrastinating over planning before you eventually make a decision, I don't know, in February, March, April time of next year.
Yeah, and the in-person aspect is lovely. I do totally get that having the online festivals has meant that many more people could see the talks. But in person, you see the bikes, you see the people, then you see them at coffee. Oh, I've got another question for you. And it's a very easy place to be here. You hear lots of stories. The most of the stories inevitably involve some hardship. We heard about the Pamir Highway yesterday. There was hardship involved there with immigration and customs and transportation and the road surface. And you do hear stories of the Type 1 fun or the Type 2 fun. Type 1 fun being stuff that's fun at the time. Type 2 fun stuff being you may well be questioning why you're doing this and why you are there at the time. But when you look back on it, you did enjoy it. That's Type 2 fun. A
bit like teaching.
Yeah.
But there we go.
I tried that once back in 2004 and 2005. Yes, I can relate to that.
Right. If I cough through this, my apologies. But you gave your talk about cycling two routes in Croatia, Slovenia and Italy and Germany.
Yeah, and Austria.
And Austria. Right, but you ended up, and you're going to talk about that now, but you ended up actually doing a different route or a different order of what you planned to do. Just talk about what happened when after you'd planned your trip.
So last festival gathering, Rob Ainsley gave a talk called Austria is Flat. It was an amusing talk.
And that's Rob Ainsley, as in the person who provides the music for this podcast, and who I told last night that I apologised to him for forgetting to give him credit on every episode of the podcast. So can I squeeze that in now? The music is credit to Rob Ainsley, and it's very good. And if I forget at the end.
Yeah, so Rob gave this talk about a trip in Austria that he'd done, and that gave me inspiration when I got back to do a bit of surfing on the web. And I came across this route that goes from Venice to Munich, largely off-road or largely on quiet roads. And so that was what my plan for this year's travel would be. So I had a flight booked from Bristol, near where I live, to Venice on Thursday the 8th of June. It was really good because it would be leave Bristol at 11, which is fairly sociable time to get there. You'd then get to Venice at early afternoon and you could get on your way. So got the flight booked. Only 6 weeks later that got cancelled. The next flight available to Venice was on the Saturday, so two days later, but leaving Bristol at 7 a.m. and although it's only a 45 minute journey to get to Bristol Airport from where I live, it's not a sociable time to do that. So I looked around at what other flights were available, and one that I looked at was Pula in Croatia. I'd been to Pula before on holiday, so I knew it was a nice location.
Where is Pula?
Oh, so Pula is in the Istrian Peninsula in northern Croatia. So it's fairly near. It's the opposite end of Dubrovnik, but certainly in the northern part of coastal part of Croatia.
And is it kind of opposite from Venice, really?
Yeah. So Venice is in the northern bit of the Adriatic. Following the coast round, you get to Trieste. And then there's just a bit of coastal Slovenia. And then maybe halfway down, towards the lower part of the Eastern Peninsula, is Pula.
So your original plan was to fly to Venice.
And then do only the Venice to Munich bike route. And in doing that, I hadn't in any point at that point intended to do the Parenzana Trail. It was when I was looking at the landing in Pula, in terms of how I'd then get to Venice to start, I then did some web surfing and came across the Parenzana Trail. The Parenzana Trail is a disused rower line that goes between Porec on the eastern coast, north of Pula, and that then goes inland through a medieval hilltop village called Motovun, then back out towards the coast, and then coming out at the Croatia-Slovenia border, before going through part of Slovenia and back out, finishing in Trieste. It's 123 kilometres long. Between Trieste and Porec, there are 33 stations that commuters that serve by it. But it opened in 1902 as a narrow gauge, but closed in 1935 under Mussolini. At the time that it opened, it was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Why, was it built as a tourist?
No, it was built to serve the inland communities. Oh. And it would be used for local freight for eggs, sheep, milk, and passenger transport.
Because it's a considerable engineering undertaking. Yeah. The terrain there in the Istrian peninsula is pretty... It's challenging. Very hilly.
Yeah, my history of the Austro-Hungarian Empire is not great, other than it clearly finished after that. But what the politics were at the time, that it was one organised country then, whether it was done to develop trade. There were certainly other railway routes around there. There's one that you might have done on the Eurovelo 8 that goes from Ravin inland a bit, right, before the... A coastal estuary that you go round. So I think they did have other railways. It's just that one they strung together as a cycle route.
So why? Sorry to bang on about the railway line, but why did it only survive for 10 years?
It made it from 33 years, from 02 to 35.
But that's pretty short lived.
Yeah, but the politics of Mussolini might not make sense to us now, possibly. Yeah. It was a narrow gauge railway. Maybe he wanted to just have standard gauge. Maybe it didn't pay. I don't know the history of it.
So basically, it's now been
been repurposed as a cycle route.
And it's part of the Eurovelo 8.
No. As I understand, Eurovelo 8 runs along coastal Croatia, and this could make, if you were doing coastal Croatia, which is it's beautiful coast, but it's quite busy with tourists. This gives you a chance to escape that, to see non-coastal Croatia. The first bit of it in Porec, the route has long since been obliterated by modern development. It starts off with segregated soccer routes. There's one bit where it passes the main road where it was a nasty crossing of a main road. Well, I just made a detour along the side of the road, along a track closer side of the road, a kilometre, and then made my way back. But apart from that, it was all on... There were on-road sections where you went through towns, but largely that was either segregated or on quiet roads.
Right. And what's it called? What's the name of the route?
It's called the Parenzana Trail, and there's a website called Parenzana.net, and it goes into various information about the route, what the community's like, and periodically along where there were stations, there might be a notice board that gives you some history as to what the community was, what it was famous for. But along the route, there are some amazing place to look at, one of which is Motovun. There's a campsite nearby. Motovun is a medieval village that's at the top of a hill. It's quite a long way up a hill. I mean, I did come across a loaded touring cyclist that cycled up this very steep hill. Within the middle of this village, there's a gated section that you then go into it's not a cathedral, but there's a big church and an like an inner courtyard. It's worth a visit. You've got views around, looking down from the hill. So I stayed at the campsite there. Small campsite, but apparently there's a swimming pool that someone after the talk told me that they'd been to. But it's it's got a covered area where you can cook in, where you can recharge your electrics. Not a particularly large campsite, but I don't think they'd turn people away.
Was it a very busy route?
I would say not very busy. You did see cyclists nearby the touristy region. So towards the end by Isola, which is on the north Slovenian coast, it was quite busy with people using the bike for using the trail for running or road racing or commuting or families on bikes. I did come across quite a few other people overall on the trail, but there were times when I saw no one for 5-10 minutes.
Mm. And was the train, was it originally a rack and pinion? I mean, steep sections?
No, it was never very steep. But both ends of the of the line start near sea level, and it's got two areas where it goes up to about 300 metres, but at no part of it was it steep. There's one part where I left Livade, which is not long after, which is from going from Porek in the south after Motovun. It felt like it was a little bit steep, but I don't think it was steep enough to be a rack and pinion railway. My guess is that with a having a narrow gauge railway means that you can go in much tighter bends, and it does have contour lines, and parts of it, when you look at it on the map, do resemble what you could do with squeezing a toothpaste tube with the squiggles that you get. I think that was just probably getting to pretty much the closest that a train could do. But there wasn't dramatic mountain scenery, but what there was some views over forests, over you had coastal views when you got to the bit where you oversee the approach of Slovenia. The approach of Slovenia was spectacular insofar as you've got a large inland estuary that goes to where the Croatian-Slovenian border is. But before that, you've got these 12th, 13th century salt flats, which have still worked. And there were some great views there. It's notable that the Paranzana.net website, the pictures they show of in the autumn, where you've got the fall, where you've got the turning leaves. I think it's one that would be quite good to do in the autumn.
Yeah. And it is all in Croatia, there's none of it that's in Slovenia?
Oh, it spans the three countries. So I'd say two-thirds of it is in Croatia. Then when you've gone past the salt flats, you then come to the border, and then you turn a corner, and then you go back out along this estuary, along the Slovenian coast. And I think that bit definitely is Eurovelo 8. And then at some point, before you get to the end of that Slovenian peninsula, you then turn inland, slightly uphill. There's an old railway bridge that you pass under, and I'm quite sure that's Eurovelo 8. I think the official GPX points that you download from Paranzana.net does take you right the way around the coast. I may be wrong, but I'm fairly sure the track didn't do that. Okay. But it does give you... It's only going to be a couple of... maybe an extra 20 kilometres to do that. But it's going to give you... it's a lovely coast. And I dare say there are more accommodation options. At this point, it's also used by the Bucket and Spade Brigade. People using it to run on, to walk on, to cycle on.
And it finishes in Trieste.
Yeah, in the outskirts of Trieste. At that point, you're still another 10-15 kilometres away from Trieste centre. Maybe I got that bit wrong, but I found finding a route into Trieste was difficult. When I looked on the Eurovelo 8 website, it didn't seem to show the route, or I couldn't find it. Trieste is obviously coastal. It's got several... it seems to be on several hillsides. There were some bicycle routes to get into Trieste. One of them looked like you need to do a bit of climbing.
I was going to say, because when I did my version of the Eurovelo 8, which by that point had completely abandoned the Eurovelo 8.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know whether it was signposted at the time, this was back in 2013. I cut across, one afternoon, I cut across Slovenia, and then I've got good memories of coming down these switchback roads, descending quite rapidly into the centre of Trieste.
Yes, and I think, had I have been bothered to cycle up some of those hills, I would have found those. Certainly once you got... the route I took was a main roadway in, but there were cycle lanes, not segregated from traffic, but there were painted lanes. But on some of these, when it then took you to a pavement bit of segregated cycling, you were then having to cross the road a few times. There were junctions that you could do this, but eventually you got to the seafront at Trieste, where there were some cycle lanes that you could take in. They were off road. They were at the water's edge, also used by pedestrians. So there were plenty of people, pedestrians wandering in.
Yeah, and Trieste's a nice city.
Yeah, I have. In a way, I regret not spending. I spent one night in Trieste. I regret. It's somewhere I could go back to. I think I alluded to the day I got in was the day after Silvio Berlusconi died, so flags were at half mast. There's some nice buildings to look at from the outside.
James Joyce lived there, and there's a statue of James Joyce.
I didn't see that.
I'm not the only person to park their bicycle next to James Joyce and take a photograph. I've seen others do it as well.
There's lots of things to take photographs in the town. There's a huge cruise ship docked in at the time, which, goodness knows how many thousand were on that. And actually just trying to follow the seafront cycle route, you were having to go past security guards who were letting people into specific areas before rejoining the boat.
Yeah. Did you cycle all the way then to Venice to pick up the route to Munich?
I did consider that. I did come up with a route that would... I mean, I could have taken Eurovelo 8 to have gone near to Venice. I came up with a route that went from Trieste to a place called Conegliano, which is part of the route. It's also got a train. I hadn't actually been feeling that great that day, so I got a train from Trieste to Conegliano, about 20 euros if I recall correctly.
Isn't Coniglio Italian for rabbit? I'm going to check that when I get home.
I don't speak Italian, but Conegliano was on the train route.
Rabbit town.
Yeah, I could have got a train. I could have got a train nearer to the start, but it was on a railway line that goes up to near Piva di. I forget the name of where it got to, but it was convenient. It was a spot on the route. It was before it got particularly hilly.
And just to backtrack a bit, this route from Venice to Munich.
Yeah.
Again, this is a long existing route, isn't it? It's not part of the Eurovelo network.
Not that I'm aware of.
It goes via the Brenner Pass.
Yes.
And it's one way of getting, one good way of cycling from southern Germany down to the Mediterranean.
I would say it's a really good way to get from across the Alps. That there's most of it. Some of it is ex-railway lines. Some of it is paths, and It doesn't, you know, you're not climbing a Stelvio Pass, or none of it was very, very steep. There were bits that I walked and pushed because, well, I was tired. The first pass you go across is the Passo di Cima Bianche, and that is 1580 metres. The approach, the 60, 70 kilometres before that, you're on ex-railway line, so gentle gradient. And then when you go over the top into the Trentino South Tyrol region, the first bit of that is on ex-railway lines. So it's all gentle gradients. It's all stuff that's quite straightforward. But before we get to that bit, you're on... Some of it is the old main road. That that's now been bypassed by the auto route. So I don't remember there being much traffic on it. Some of that bit, there were off-road parts. You went along routes at the side of some couple of lakes. And then there's a campsite I stayed that on the way. But the approach to that bit of the line, a Piva di Cadore, some of that bit was quite steep. But once you're on that, you're on railway line, X-Railway lines. After that, you're approaching... you go through Simmerbankshire, and then you go on... It's not a straight route, but then you... The route turns a corner going to the west. On that bit, there's still an active railway line, so you're on paths or quiet roads. And then you get to the Brixen to Brenner Valley, and that is an active cycle route. The first part before you get to Simmerbankshire, you're at the side of a railway line. And then there's a switchback that the train does take, but then you come to a bit before you get to Brenner where they've built a newish tunnel that opened in 1994. Plefecture Tunnel. But that soon will be bypassed by the Brenner Tunnel, which will be a 55-kilometre tunnel that goes south from Innsbruck towards Brixen.
So is Brenner the border between Italy and Austria?
Yes. So that one's not quite as high. That's at 1,300 or so metres. But
why is the Brenner Pass so famous? Because everybody's heard of the Brenner Pass.
It's a border town for road transport and for rail transport. At that border, there's a large railway station with many, many sidings. So my guess is that in post-war Europe, where trade was still going across borders, this would have been a border town with customs houses, with trade going from Italy to Austria.
Is it the only pass? Is it the main pass between Italy and Austria?
I don't know if it's the only pass, but it's certainly a major pass. So even following the railway line that is still active, it's still quite squiggling going around curves, whereas this Brenner Pass that will be due for completion in 2032, it will be straight. I can't remember if it's twin tunnel, but for freight, it will be much quicker. So that the trains have to climb those hills to get to the pass. So there's energy involved in doing that. Yeah. So maybe it will streamline the non-road transport.
And when you're passing over the Brenner Pass,
yeah,
is it on cycle route? Are you on the road? Or?
The last 10-15 kilometres from the rail switchback, where this since 1994 has been disused, that takes you into Brenner on almost entirely traffic-free routes. On that route, there's a business called Route 232, which is a disused building. Now it's a cafe, frequented by cyclists. That gave me an extra several kilometres of range with my legs stocking up there. After Brenner, you're then on main road for a lot of the route down towards Innsbruck. I would say that the first bit after Brenner, north of Brenner, is then quite a steep downhill bit on this main road. I did that, it was fairly busy. So going downhill, you could go quite quickly. I would not like to do that bit in reverse. If I was to do that route in reverse, which I may well do, I've got to be honest, that bit I would do by train. I don't mind hills because, well, I'll just push. But it was busy. There's no cycle route. There's no segregated. It was just a road. That bit wasn't pleasant. So I stayed at an Airbnb. There were no office campsites along the valley. There were if you diverted up a side valley some distance. But I was getting a bit tired then. So I just went to a guest house that I saw on the web. And that was lovely. I got talking to some German cyclists also staying there. They confirmed my suspicion that taking a bike on a train in Germany isn't so straightforward. And so I was also running a bit short of time. So in the morning, I did 11 kilometres, went to another rower station, took a train to Innsbruck, had a wander around Innsbruck, because I like, Innsbruck's lovely, I'd been before, quite touristy, of which I was one, of course. Then I got another train to Jenbach. Jenbach is east of Innsbruck by, I don't know, 60 kilometres? That's a total guess, it may not be right. So Jenbach, at Jenbach, the route then heads north, and you've got a 4 kilometre section where you're going up 335 metres to Ackensee. Well, it so happened that there's a steam train with a rack and pinion that goes up that. So for 30 or so euros, me and the bike and I took that train, and that it was very pleasant. It wasn't quick. It was climbing a hill. Ackensee, on the other hand, when you get to the top, is this beautiful lake, still in Austria. Most of the people on the train were then taking a boat trip to cruise around the lake for a bit. I hung around, then cycled along the cycle route that goes around Ackensee. It really was beautiful. And I then continued north on the Venice cycle path until I got to Tegernsee, and I stayed at Tegernsee. There's a campsite there. I should add, before you get to Tegernsee, the route then splits. There are two options to Venice on the official route. There's the east route that goes via Tegernsee, or the west route. I can't remember the major place it goes through.
This is the route to Munich?
Yes.
Not the route to Venice?
No, yes. So once you are in Bavaria, a little bit further on, there's a signpost that gives you the option to take the east route or the west route. I opted for the east route because I'd been in Tegernsee area in the early 90s, and I liked it very much. I thought quite like to revisit it. So there's a campsite at Tegernsee, southwest of the Lake Tegernsee by a kilometre or so. The official route goes north, taking the east route of Tegernsee, whereas if you take, the west, the official route goes on the west side. I went on the east, and that takes you via the town of Tegernsee with its monastery, where in the basement of that, in the vaulted ceilings of that, it is a beer house. And I had been there in the early 90s. So I had a look around Tegernsee there. I also went to the nearby railway station. I was using the Deutsche Bahn app, and that indicated there was limited availability for getting a train to Strasbourg. But the lady there at the counter, she had a look and said, "Oh, no, I can't do that, sorry." But she used this phrase that several German cyclists I'd met used, which was, "It's complicated." So at this point, I thought, right, let's hurry on towards Munich. So I got as far as... I then continued north, close to Wangau, close to Miesbach, and then close to Holzkirchen. After Holzkirchen, you're then no longer on quiet roads, but you're on dedicated cycle lanes. These were 4 metre wide. They might be either close to the side of the road or close to a railway. So there's the railway and the cycle path in the woods. And really, really smooth surface, well maintained. And along that, pelotons of cyclists in matching garb would belt past. It was quiet. You could just go along. And with those wide cycle paths, the pelotons could go umpteen abreast.
So how long had it taken you to get from the rabbit town, Conigliano?
I think that was sort of, we're looking at five, six days-ish.
Okay.
I had originally allowed 2 weeks to do that. Right. It had my original plan of arriving at Venice, then picking up the route then. I was aiming to take 7-8 days, and then maybe cycle a bit further to the German part of Eurovelo 6, then travel west to France, where I knew I could easily, from past experience...
So you didn't have a flight booked for the way back?
No, not at all, no. I I just flew once, and the plan was only ever to then take trains back. So I then, from Tegernsee, I then went to the... It's not a municipal campsite, but it's a campsite that's a few kilometres away from the centre of Munich. It was a perfectly fine campsite. There's a 8 foot, 2.5 metre tall fence, security fence. There's no shop, but within a kilometre of that was a supermarket that was also very close to an underground station. So that would make a good campsite to stop off to then see Munich. I stayed one night there and then cycled further, 11 kilometres further, to finish the route at the Deutsche Museum. I then went on to the railway station the Munich Hauptbahnhof is quite a large affair. So I took a ticket to the customer support area, where you could then talk to someone who could then book. So I asked him about getting to Paris, and sorry, sir. I then asked about going to Innsbruck on the train. So, no, I can't do that directly, but I can do it indirectly. So, yes, please. So,
booked. But why would you want to go back to Innsbruck?
It was apparent that it would not be possible easily to go to Strasbourg to get home.
But you're going in the wrong direction if you go to Innsbruck.
That is also quite true. That it was looking very difficult to go back home by train, certainly on the intercity trains.
So, did you go to Innsbruck?
Yeah.
And so, where did you go from Innsbruck?
Okay, well, let me talk through the way home. So, the gentleman at Munich railway station gave me tickets firstly to Kufstein, then from Kufstein to Innsbruck. On that second train, I then booked a train from Innsbruck to Zurich using the Austrian app, which worked brilliantly, so I could book me the bike and myself onto that train. On that train from Innsbruck to Zurich, I then used a Swiss app to book the bike and me from Zurich to Basel. On that train from Zurich to Basel, I used the SNCF app to book me and the bike from Basel to Strasbourg, and
so
also a hotel.
You did get there eventually.
Oh, absolutely.
And you did all that in one day.
Yeah, this is all one day. But that train was then going to get into Strasbourg at about 8 p.m. So I also knew from the SNCF app that I could get from Strasbourg to Paris. Availability there was 5 a.m. the next day, or 7, 8 p.m. that same day, but getting to Paris at 9 p.m. I had no desire to get into Paris at that time in the evening, so I booked a hotel in Strasbourg by the railway station. So thought, brilliant, all sorted. So got into Basel, and at that point then the train to take us and everyone else to Strasbourg never came. And then word got around from the railway staff that a tree had come down between Basel and Mulhouse. So a rail replacement bus was arranged. That came at about 9-ish. And they were able to take the bike, and everyone squeezed on the bus to get us to Mulhouse. So at Mulhouse, a number of us were waiting for a train for onwards travel to Strasbourg. That train didn't arrive until 1 a.m, which meant that we then got to and the other stranded passengers didn't get to Strasbourg until 2 a.m.
But you booked your hotel in
And Strasbourg. I had a hotel booked. So I did get my money's worth from that hotel. My plan was to get into Strasbourg at 8 p.m, dump the bike, have a wander around, bite to eat, take some pictures of illuminated buildings. My exploration of Strasbourg will wait for another trip.
So, and then to get home, what did you use?
Yeah, so to get home, I got this 5:30 a.m. trip from Strasbourg on the TGV, and that worked brilliantly. That region of TGV, and my understanding is it's different for different parts of TGV. You can book a bike on the TGV. I think I may have paid extra for it, but you could take a full bike. You didn't have to dismantle it. You take your panniers off and put it in the rack, and there was a limited number of places for bikes on that trip. There were two other cyclotourists there, so good old chat there. That on that bit of the journey, the first part to Nancy, it's on quite slow, standard track. But after Nancy, then it gets on TGV and it motors along. So I get into Paris at 9 a.m. Initially, I cycle in towards the river, and I wander around the outskirts of Notre Dame. Well, of course, not for obvious reasons, Notre Dame is closed and fenced off, but on these fences are lots of pictures of what's going on. So there's lots of pictures of the damage and how they're repairing it. There are sections through. I didn't realise, for instance, that the vaulted ceilings that in some cathedrals you can walk on, these are only 2 stones thick. So you've got the outer dress stone that you might walk on and are watertight when mortared, and then the inner side of that are what was the ceiling that you'd look up before. Only 2 stones thick, curved, being a structural engineer, with all of those stones in compression, it's an arch, that's what holds it up. Impressively what they built with what to us might be primitive tools 1,800 years ago, but also to see how they've got the craftsman rebuilding it in the sympathetic way. So that was quite fascinating. Then I found a cafe, roadside cafe, where I could keep an eye on the bike and I could refuel before then taking a train to Caen, leaving at not long after midday. So on Caen there were several other cyclotourists. I think on that one you definitely did have to book, and I there are different philosophies that in taking trains on bikes. With Taya it's generally free. I have had somewhere I think I've had to book and maybe pay on Taya, or an intercity trains where you would have to book, and that might be €10.
I think the TER is free.
Yeah.
I think it's free.
There may be some you have to book.
Yeah, I think the TGV you need to.
Yeah. Out of choice, this might sound quite flash, out of choice I'd rather pay €10 on an intercity where I have that ticket, I've got a space booked. On one trip I took last year, when I took a train from Nantes to Pornichet, I did have a bike space booked, and I put my bike on and another cyclist turned up, but it was also a school being used for school. It really was shoulder to shoulder. I mean, everyone took care of each other, and you know, when I went to get a drink bottle, that, you know, a space created, and you know, around that space I could get my arm and my drink bottle to get a drink. It really was heaving.
So door to door,
yeah.
From leaving your house in Somerset to getting back home, how many weeks have you been away?
I'd been away 2 weeks. Uh-huh. So I got to Caen. Two cyclotourists I was talking to were then taking the afternoon sailing to Portsmouth from Ouistreham, which is very close to Caen. I there was space I could do that, but that would then get me into Portsmouth, which to then get a train back to Castlecary. That was after the last train back to Castlecary had gone. So I just stayed at a local campsite and then took the morning sailing to Portsmouth.
And do you regret not having taken a plane back?
No. I mean, I would prefer to take less trains, but I didn't think that I could get to Venice, or Pula, as it turned out, in time to then do the Venice to Munich bike trail in 2 weeks. Not because you could do that trail in 2 weeks, but to train there and train back. Think about it latterly, I think maybe a better way to have done it would have been to ferry over to France, get a train to Paris, then a long distance train to the south coast, and then to get a train through southern France to Italy to Venice.
Well, you could have got a train from Paris to Milan, although currently I think the tunnel is closed, isn't it?
Yeah.
To Milan, so that's currently out of action.
Yeah. So and Milan would have been en route really to get to Venice following those routes. Yeah. So yes, I would have had 2 weeks easy to have done So I was only planning to fly one way. I'd done a similar trip before, flying to Marseille and then going along the Med, and then doing the Canal du Midi via Toulouse, and then the Garonne, and then I took local trains through from near Bordeaux up to Nantes and then to the coast. I have alluded to going to Castle Carey. I live in the southwest of England, and I'm really fortunate that at Castle Carey I can get two trains to Portsmouth, two different trains to Poole, one maybe two trains depending which one you get to Plymouth, all of which are ferry ports. So I'm really fortunate in that respect. I got the morning train, the morning ferry to Portsmouth. Having dropped the bike, the first thing I did was to go to the restaurant. Now they have cafes and they have restaurants for breakfast. So first thing I got on, I was hungry, wanted breakfast. They have a restaurant, and for something like £20, it's buffet. You know, you could have a cooked breakfast. You'd then go to the buffet and have a cereal breakfast. You then go back to the buffet and have a continental breakfast. It pretty much was all you could eat. So I think possibly I got better value than going to the, and it was deserted. I went there first of all, got a seat with a window seat so you could watch. I was probably in there a good half an hour, 40 minutes, munching away.
So where next? Where's the next train?
Cycling
journey to?
Yeah, after Portsmouth, I was there at college in the 80s, so I knew it well.
I mean next, as in next, your next cycle?
I have to say, I don't know. I've got plenty to think about from the trips that we've had spoken to us about this festival. I alluded to earlier that I cycled the Carretera Austral in Chile in 2019. So in the 2019 festival, Ed Mark Shawcross and his wife gave a talk about the Carretera Austral. And I was planning to have a sort of a midlife crisis trip at the end of 19, start of 20, and South America was on my radar. So to hear Ed and Charlie's talk about the Carretera Austral, my eyes lit up. That was what I did. I mean, we could talk a lot about the Carretera Austral, but until Chile becomes part of Europe, we possibly can't talk about it on the podcast. But if anyone is interested, there, my account of it is on the Crazy Guy on a Bike website, which, for those that haven't heard of it, it's a brilliant resource where people blog their trips. I mean, many people have their own blog and own website, as do you, but the Crazy Guy on a website is a good place to look for resources. So if you go to the journals page of Carretera Austral and type in the word Tim Sanders, there's no you in Saunders, just Sanders, or type in Carretera Austral, you'll find the Carretera Austral is a 1237 kilometre route that largely got created by Pinochet, the dictator in the 80s and 90s.
There's a theme here. Dictators. But anyway.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, you know,
this is the first podcast where we've mentioned, I think, two dictators.
See, some people would attribute motorways to Hitler. Yeah. But
well, that's three now.
Yeah.
But do you want to get, I don't know, we won't, do you want to get Thatcher in there as well?
We won't mention the war. So the Carretera Austral is a 1237 kilometre route between Puerto Montt, De Vere or O'Higgins. Chile is very narrow. You cannot drive then, and I don't think you can now, you cannot drive from the main, say, Santiago. You cannot drive to the Puerto Natales without either taking a boat or driving through Argentina, and they've not always been friends. But the Carretera was a route to get further and further that way. It's a well-known route. I was in Chile for 6 weeks. I took a gap from work. So South America is definitely on the radar, but I think it won't be for a while. It's not something you do in 2 weeks. You do want to be... So it's on the radar for one day. I alluded to earlier, living close to in the South Coast, so you know, within an hour or so, maybe 2 hours of train rides, I'm at a French port. So for me, going to France is easy. And when you need a stress-free break from work, it's easy to do. But I'm also aware, there's loads of France I haven't seen. I would not be... If someone said, Tim, you can no longer take any more holidays outside of France, I wouldn't be too upset. There's so, you know, you've spoken on podcasts about the Eurovelo routes. I've met Jeff Husband many times, who runs Breton Bikes in Gorek in Brittany. It would be no hardship to go back there. The Nantes-Brest Canal, you can do most of that on. If you don't want to do the canal, you can also do a bit on some of the Brittany Green routes. There are two books by a Brittany-based book firm, Red Hat Books, maybe. And they've got one book on the Voyverts which aren't the Nantes-Brest Canal, ex-railway lines, and there's another book that they do on the Nantes-Brest Canal. But you and I both know that you go further. I've done some of the Loire, Eurovelo 6. It really, really lovely. But, you know, the festival we've just had, there's several routes that you mentioned, the one from Roscoff to Normandy. That sounds quite fun.
The Vélo Maritime.
The Vélo Maritime. Yeah. I've also done some of the Velocini that... I did it a few weeks before you, so, you know, we spoke campsites a bit. Yeah, I mean, I would prefer not to fly if I can, but there are many places... To take the Paris Honour Trail, for instance, it would have been... That's even further round from Venice. That would be more difficult to do in 2 weeks from the UK. There's low, you know, I look forward to one day retiring and doing some of these, or, you know, I joke with friends that I keep looking out for, you know, a job advert for wanted full-time bicycle tourist, apply within. You know, I that hasn't appeared on LinkedIn so far.
No. Yeah, I'm looking for that too. Yeah. Right, well, thank you, and enjoy your cycle back down to Somerset from Lancashire.
Unfortunately, I have to confess, I will be driving my 18-year-old Audi down, visiting my father on the way.
Shame on you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Tim for agreeing to have that chat in the rain over in Clitheroe about a month ago. And as you probably heard, I had a cold at the time, and I can't believe that now, a month later, I'm recording this and I've got another cold. That's why I sound so croaky. Hopefully next time I'll be back up to 100% fitness, and I won't be croaking my way through either the interview or the introductions. Anyway, thank you for listening. This has been episode 76 of the Cycling Europe podcast. If you want to contact Tim, by the way, you can do so. The easiest way to do that is to look for at Tim and his bike on social media. He's on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and he will answer anybody's questions if you've got them. So thank you for Tim for agreeing to talk to the podcast. If you'd like to talk to the podcast, then please get in touch. You can do so by visiting the contacts page on cyclingeurope.org/contacts. And if you'd like to support the podcast, then you can do that by visiting cyclingeurope.org/support. Thank you to all those people who, over the course of the last 5 years, 6 years, have very generously supported the podcast. And that's it for episode 76. As I say, I'll be back very soon with episode 77. In fact, I may well be croaking through that because I'm interviewing the people at 6 p.m. tonight. I suspect you may hear this croaky voice at least once more, certainly when it comes to asking the questions. So thank you for listening, and happy cycling.